I'm sure all of you listening and watching have known somebody that's had a cardiovascular event, and it's scary because sometimes it can really be that silent killer. Hi, everyone. Today we're going to talk about how you can protect your heart in menopause. So we're going to talk about labs, supplements, and hormones. I'm Dr. Valerie Davidson.
And I'm Dr. Robert Mackey. So we were going to do a live event for our community.
Yep, so this is our presentation here.
Yeah, so we're going to do a little bit of everything, kind of an overview. Now, heart disease, everyone thinks of heart disease as being, heart disease is more like an umbrella topic. But heart disease, as we think about it, is more atherosclerosis, which is a subset of heart disease. Heart disease has a whole bunch of things underneath it. Atherosclerosis, the type of pathology that causes heart attacks, and in strokes for that matter. That's sort of what we're talking about today.
I'm sure all of you listening and watching have known somebody that's had a cardiovascular event, and it's scary because sometimes it can really be that silent killer. You know, they talk about atherosclerosis, which is like that widow maker, which is that one artery. What is it? The left carotid
The
or
left
left
LAD, the left
CD. What was
anterior
it?
descending artery. So when you
The
look at
widow
it,
maker. Which one is that one?
that same one, yeah, LAD,
The
yes.
widow maker, and then what's the other one? The grim reaper.
Yeah, the RCA, the right coronary artery. Those are the two most common. So when people have a, which we'll get into in a little bit, when people have their a coronary calcium score, you know, a
Which
C,
not everybody has had, and not
yeah.
everybody even knows what that is.
Right. It's a CT scan, right? So it's basically taking an X-ray. X-rays pick up calcified things, so it looks at your bones really well. So if you have plaque inside of your arteries, your coronary arteries that supply your heart's kind of like right in the middle of your chest. So if you have plaque in those four arteries that supply your heart, the two main ones is the LAD, like you said, the widow maker, the left anterior descending, and the RCA, the right coronary artery. Those two are the most predominant. I don't know what the statistics are, but certainly the LAD, that one is the blood supply to the left ventricle. So if you have a heart attack in that one, and it's a significant one, now you can damage that left ventricle, and now the pump, the heart itself, doesn't work very well. So when people do these, you know, we've had lots of patients do them over the years. We have them do a coronary calcium score. They are assessing how much calcium is there. Based on that, you know, based on that procedure. You know, meaning the more calcium, the more atherosclerosis, you could assume then the higher the score, zero to whatever, the higher the score, then the more risk that they have.
So you can see how important knowing what your calcium score is. But like I said, a lot of people don't really know what that is, or they haven't had it tested or ordered for them. Most people are familiar with your cholesterol panel. So there's like the total cholesterol, there's your triglycerides, there's your HDLs, your high density lipoproteins, and then there's your low density lipoproteins. Those are the most common when you're doing a lipid panel. And then there's also, you can have the very low density lipoproteins. And then, of course, there's the expanded version that you can do for that Boston Cleveland heart test too. But we all know it's not all about cholesterol when it comes to heart disease, is it?
No, you know, granted, there's been lots of medications that are used for cholesterol, cholesterol and lipid management, but cholesterol sort of gets a bad rap. I mean, it's an extremely important molecule in the body. Every cell, our brain, everything, our hormones, especially sex hormones, testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, all of those are made from cholesterol, right? Every cell in our body is made from cholesterol. So Mother Nature doesn't really make a lot of mistakes that way, that, you know, something that you need in order to stay alive, is going to cause problems. But, as we know, cholesterol does play, or at least LDL and ApoB and all these things we've heard about all these days, you know, over the last 50 years, they do play a role in the progression or the pathophysiology of heart disease.
And we all know that with the estrogen, you know, estrogen has a huge impact on our cardiovascular system. But I will say from clinical practice, and you probably have seen this too, I remember thinking, you know, when somebody goes into menopause, I'll look at their cholesterol panel and I'll see how their cholesterol starts to go up. And they might gain a little weight, and we'll say, okay, yeah, you're going into menopause, you're gaining weight, your cholesterol's going up. And sometimes I'll say, well, maybe genetics is catching up with you because, yeah, your mom or dad or both had high cholesterol. Maybe genetics is catching up with you. But I remember over the years, is seeing that trend of when my patients would go through menopause, their LDL cholesterol in particular, not as much the triglycerides, but the LDL cholesterol would just start going up. It would
Right.
just, boop, 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 boop. And we do know there is a mechanism behind, estrogen and estradiol keeping the cholesterol down. And then when you go into menopause and even perimenopause, late perimenopause, when that estrogen starts to drop, you will see that cholesterol go up. Now, like I said, we all know cholesterol isn't the be all end all for a cardiovascular event, but it is one, piece to look at to watch the body change.
The thing is about using cholesterol lowering medications. The idea that you can just take one pill and it's going to protect you, from having a stroke or a heart attack, that's ultimately what we're talking about. At the end of the day, I don't want to have a stroke or a heart attack. You don't want to have a stroke or a heart attack. All of our patients don't want to have a stroke or a heart attack. The people listening do not want to have a stroke or heart attack. So how do we put ourselves in the best situation to prevent that? If forever, or if anything, you have a heart attack and you die in your sleep or something when you're like 95. Okay. I mean, something, along those lines where it doesn't impact us too early. Okay. Like you said about estrogen, women, you very rarely hear about women having heart attacks before the age of 50, right? You see people in the media, celebrities, athletes, and musicians. If they're around 50, under 50, over 50, it's usually one of two reasons, either drugs or it's a heart attack, one of the two, right? You see a man die and he's around the age of 45 to 55, you can assume he had a heart attack, most of the time, if there's not any recreational drug use or something else going on there. If there's usually a high prediction that if there is an event there or whatever happened. And that's, not to speculate, but just the most common or explanation why someone just all of a sudden they go to their doctor every year, which does happen a lot. You go to your doctor every year, they do your cholesterol panel, your cholesterol's fine, you're on medication, and then boom, you drop dead. Okay. That's sort of what everyone's trying to prevent. Nobody really wants that to happen. But how do you predict who's at risk and who doesn't? How do you determine where your risk is? And if your risk is high, one determining where you are. If your risk is high, how do you lower that risk over time? Is that even possible?
So that's kind of something I think we should talk about right now is looking at the risk. Like what creates a higher risk, especially for a female that's gone through menopause or is going through menopause? What are you looking at to see if they have a risk for heart disease? Like I've had some patients, I'll send their lab work to them before their appointment, and they'll say they stayed up all night or they were crying because their cholesterol went up. Am I going to have a heart attack? Am I going to die? And I'm like, wait, that's just one risk factor. But you're right, it's a little bit where people don't really know what are you looking at to determine someone's risk.
Yeah, sure. And honestly, we've been sort of conditioned because, like I said, there's lots of medications that are used to lower cholesterol over the last, 5, 6 decades. Maybe not quite that long, but at least since you and I have been alive, cholesterol has been kind of beat into us that we want to keep our cholesterol low.
Or remember when they say don't eat foods high in cholesterol? I think now everybody knows that it's okay, but back in the 90s, everything was fat-free.
Yeah, right. Yeah, fat, dietary fat. I mean, sort of like people that have gone on a carnivore diet, they get these huge, not everyone, but some people, they get an increase to their total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol. Usually triglycerides go down if they're doing a carnivore diet. But looking
A
just
lot.
at what you're alluding to, because we both have had this situation many times, people sort of panic because now their LDL, or their, excuse me, their total cholesterol will be above 200.
So the total cholesterol, I'll say it, I'm sure you agree with me, is you can scan it, but don't even use, I wouldn't even use that as looking for a marker
No.
because the total cholesterol is looking at your LDL cholesterol, that low density lipoprotein, but it's also taking into consideration the HDL cholesterol, the high density lipoproteins. So the high density lipoproteins, that's the most beneficial. So the higher, the better. And a lot of women tend to run a little higher in the HDL cholesterol. So if they're higher, it's going to make the total look falsely elevated.
Sure.
So I think you've always said, which I would love for you to talk about, the LDLs and then those triglycerides. So the triglycerides are a little bit different when you're looking at the whole risk factor.
Yeah, so like I said, you can't just look at total cholesterol or even an LDL cholesterol and determine anything, right? It's just such a poor predictor of where someone is on that continuum of low risk, No risk, low risk, moderate risk, high risk, or really high risk, right? So there's a spectrum there of where people fall in. Using just a total cholesterol, you can't tell anything from that. Okay, now maybe if they have a familial hypercholesterolemia, maybe their numbers in the 400s. Okay, maybe you could assume something based on that. But that would, as a clinician, you'd want to do a bunch of other testing, and you'd have some family history that there is a bunch of heart disease in the family. Okay, so now what you're alluding to is looking at triglycerides, which I think is on a standard lipid panel. I think the triglycerides is the most important number on a standard lipid panel. Okay, so triglycerides is basically how your body carries blood, fat in your blood. Excuse me, it's not cholesterol, but it is considered a blood fat. But it doesn't go up because of our dietary fat. It goes up, that's a lot of people don't realize, because of how much carbohydrates and sugar we consume. Sugar gets turned into triglycerides. Your insulin status determines what your triglycerides are. That's why I think the triglycerides are really important. Now, Ben Bickman, my little researcher crush that I have at BYU, they're I think 8-0 this year.
They're awesome. Their football team.
I
Oh
think
my
they're ranked
gosh.
number 7 right now in the country. Good for them. He talks about this ratio, and it's not just him. I'm not sure if he came up with it, who came up with it, but it's sort of circling around the interwebs in YouTube of taking triglyceride divided by HDL. Okay, now what you and I have seen many, many times, like you said, women proportionally are going to have a higher HDL than men. Okay. Just in general, on your last blood work that we did in January, do you remember what yours was? Yours was pretty good, like in the 70s, I want to say.
The HDLs, yeah, I think it was like 76 or something. Yeah, it was good.
Now, mine was actually pretty good. Mine
Yeah.
was like 68, for a man, 62. It was in the 60s. All I remember was in the 60s. So my triglycerides were in the 50s. My HDL was in the 60s. So that ratio, triglycerides to HDL ratio, mine was less than 1.5. I think mine was even less than one. Yours was even lower than mine because your triglycerides were lower than mine and your HDLs were higher than mine. Okay. That right there, that is a good metric. That tells me, the practitioner or another doctor, tells how insulin sensitive or lack of insulin resistance someone is. The higher that ratio, triglycerides divided by HDL. So you can do the math, just use your calculator on your phone, divide the triglycerides by the HDL, and it'll give you a number. And that number should be less than 1.5. Okay. That is a better predictor, just that one metric, than looking at your total or even your LDL for that matter. Okay. Now, you and I were talking about ApoB earlier because you brought up a good point. You're talking about a situation where someone might have normal LDL or slightly elevated, but now their ApoB is a little different. What is the case you were talking about looking at ApoB?
Oh, that was my own. So my LDL cholesterol, I think it's 110. I can't remember exactly, but I remember it was like 110. And granted, these reference ranges on these cholesterol lab results you get back are kind of ridiculous. They want the LDL cholesterol to be under 99. Back in 2016, it was 130, 130 and
130.
below. So, all these people. So technically on my cholesterol LDLs at 110 is showing that I'm technically high. I am not high. That is not high. I don't believe it's high. But my apolipoprotein B is at 72, which is pretty low. I mean, that's a pretty good number. The anything under 90 is, is a good, very low risk. So I had another person that I was looking at, and their cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, was actually lower than mine at like 80 something, 84, 89. But her LDL cholesterol was higher, like up in the high 70s. And then I had another person I looked at, and her LDL cholesterol was like I think it was like exactly like mine, like 110 or 112. And then her apolipoprotein B was up at 99. And I'd always thought I heard that the LDL cholesterol matches your apolipoprotein B. And the apolipoprotein B is what's going to tell you if that cholesterol is going to seed itself into the arterial walls, creating atherosclerosis.
The ApoB.
Yes, the apolipoprotein B, depending on if it's high, that means you have a higher risk of that LDL cholesterol, of cholesterol itself and calcium adhering to the arterial walls to create that atherosclerosis, like the Widowmaker and the Grim Reaper. So I was just kind of wondering, how can I can why do I see other people with LDL cholesterols that don't match up with their ApoBs It just seems like there's a discrepancy. So I feel like there is sort of a missing link between the ApoB, apolipoprotein B, and then that LDL cholesterol. It's not a one for one, because I know a
You want it
lot,
to be very black and white, don't you?
a lot of doctors do, and a lot of doctors do say that, oh, you have high LDL cholesterol, I'll give you a statin drug, and that will lower your LDL, which will lower apolipoprotein
Without
B.
even checking
Yeah,
it.
without even, it'll just lower that, and then that lowers your risk for atherosclerosis. So another
That,
risk
that's a
factor.
big generalization I think a lot of cardiologists make is that if your LDL is high, you might as well just take a statin drug and you're good to go.
Yeah, because it'll lower your apolipoprotein B. So when we're talking about risk factors and explaining that in this presentation, so we're looking at the LDL cholesterol, we're looking at the triglycerides, we're looking at that HDL and that ratio you were talking about. So there we already have like three risk factors we're looking at. And then we can also add on as a blood test an apolipoprotein B to see where that level is. Because I do feel like there are people like me, technically, I have high LDL cholesterol, but my apolipoprotein B is so low, it doesn't mean it's going to cause heart disease. So there's another, so there's a fourth risk factor we can look at. So we can, because that's where I feel like people feel like the waters are muddied. How do I know if I have a higher risk for heart disease just because my mom or my dad had heart disease or something? What, sure, family history is another risk factor. So I feel like the water is muddy, that they're just looking at, cholesterol, where we need to look at a lot more. And even with menopause, treating a woman past menopause, whether they're on HRT, treating them a little bit differently, or somebody that has never been on HRT, you might treat them a little bit differently when you're looking at heart disease.
And what we hear a lot from women that are reaching out, they're trying to adjust their hormones, and they're always wanted they always say, I want to protect their bones, their brain, and their heart, all the time. Those three things come back, which I completely understand. And I think that's the advantage that women have of their female hormones that they lose when they go into menopause. They now that protection is sort of taken away. So how do you replace that? What do your blood levels need to be of estradiol to give you back that protection? I think that's a kind of a loaded question or a difficult question to answer.
There's so many facets to it. So like you said, it's not black and white. So let's say you gave somebody some HRT, some hormone replacement, and it's just a static dose. Maybe it's not a really high dose, but it takes away their hot flashes and night sweats, so they get better sleep. Their brain's a little clearer, so they feel better. And they feel like they're doing something positive for themselves. And so maybe, hey, I feel better. I slept good. I'm going to exercise. I'm going to not go to the sugar today because I have more energy. And you see that ball start rolling. So what was it that helped, their metabolic health? Was it just the HRT? Was it just the estrogen? Or was it a combination of all of that? But I do will tell you, just from being in clinical practice, and I know you've seen this too, when I start a patient on HRT that has some form of estrogen in it, I do see that their cholesterol goes down.
The
For, maybe it's just the estrogen I'm thinking, or like I said, it's that whole multifactorial effect that comes from it.
well, especially with rhythmic dosing at those kind of levels, the estradiol does have sort of an anti-inflammatory effect to it, which is where I think some of the benefit of having those hormones around protects a woman, right? Higher estradiol means lower inflammation. They go into menopause, the estrogen disappears, like it literally goes to nothing almost when a woman's in menopause. Now that inflammation goes up, because now two things, the inflammation that increases heart disease increases, and because of that, they become more insulin resistant, or at least there's some level of metabolic dysfunction there. So now it starts to compound on itself, where prior to that, depending on their comorbidity status, if their comorbidity status was good before menopause, more than likely it's going to be relatively fine after menopause. But they're still taking away part of that protection that they don't, that used to be there before. Right. So by adding in the hormones, you see a change in cholesterol. What exactly is happening there? Is it just, an inflammatory, a reduction in inflammation response? What's the direct connection? Do you have any insights on that?
Well, women do, I do think when the hormones go down, the inflammation goes up. Like you said, insulin can go up. In fact, estrogen and progesterone have an effect on insulin receptors on the cell. So when they go down, then you're not as insulin sensitive. Also, estrogen and progesterone to this effect a little bit more, not as big is when you're cycling as a female and you're gaining some weight. Okay, we gain some weight. the hormones tend to push that weight gain into more like the superficial tissue. So we call it kind of the roly-poly. So it pushes it into the roly-poly, which is, it's not fun to not fit into your pants, but at the same time, it's not damaging. But when that estrogen and progesterone, particularly the estrogen, drop, then that fat accumulation, if you do gain weight, doesn't necessarily go to that periphery like your hips and thighs and kind of, muffin top. It goes on the inside. It actually has more of a tendency to go towards that visceral fat, which visceral fat is not roly-poly. Visceral fat is inflammatory. Visceral fat is going to create inflammation, which can lead to all sorts of chronic conditions, let alone heart disease.
Yeah, so the subcutaneous fat, the fat
The roly-poly.
that prevents us from having six-pack abs, right? That's the part that is sort of metabolically inert, like it doesn't do anything. We just don't like it as much because, the more we have of it, the more we lack, muscle definition for men or whatever.
What do they call man bod, what dad bod?
Yeah, dad bod. Yeah, right. Dad bod. Now, granted, dad bod is a combination of
Yeah.
subcutaneous
Soft,
and visceral
like the
fat.
beer belly. Yeah.
Especially the bigger the beer belly, the bigger that beer belly, the more visceral fat they have
Yeah,
because
it's
that's,
hard.
but even still, even some of that muffin top that you're talking about, even some of that, because it's central adiposity, they call it, right? Right around that, midsection or spare tire, you could say that some of that is probably visceral fat as well.
I mean, there is some fat in the tissues, I will say, because this made me remind me of a story of way back when is so, everybody that's probably been listening to this knows my own history of, I've had endometriosis and hyperproliferation and cysts and polyps and different things. But I remember I had an endometriosis surgery. This was back, gosh, 2010 maybe. And the doctor was showing, my gynecologist was showing me pictures, and there was like this yellow stuff inside my, my cavity, my body cavity. And I was like, what is that? I go, is that fat? Because it's kind of like lobuled. And he goes, yeah, sometimes people have like a little fat. That's normal. And he goes, you don't have a lot, though. I've seen a lot. But I don't think he understood at the time, like in 2009 or 2010, that visceral fat, more of that is probably contributing to more inflammation. He did. But I remember looking at it and seeing a little bit. It was
Well, I
weird.
wonder if that was because you've always been very slender, right? So I can't imagine that if you did then or now have a lot of visceral fat, if that was actually brown fat, because you know how brown fat is. I mean, it might have been
It
yellow.
was bright yellow. It was weird.
Yeah. I don't know what it looks like. Things we talk about, in medicine. I mean, besides cadaver lab when we were in school, otherwise you never see these things, right? You never, except on maybe an imaging study, which. You really don't, you just see sort of a version of it. You don't actually see it. So, yeah, it'd be wild to be a surgeon and like digging inside someone's body, like the things that they see. I had a speaking of that, I've only had one surgery. I was 19 at the time. Probably a little bit of a HIPAA violation in hindsight, but I had a hernia operation when I was 19. I was lifting weights and I was doing like a leg press and I felt this burning sensation and kind of in my groin. I'm like, oh, that doesn't feel very good. And of course, I kept lifting weights, trying to just push through it. And of course, I had like a whole bunch of weight on there. I was, kind of like trying to be all strong and stuff. But then it just kept, it sort of kept, hurting a little bit. And then all of a sudden, I had this little thing pop out, like right in my pubic hair area. Okay, so it wasn't what they call an inguinal hernia. What I had was what they call a sliding hernia, where I could like cough and it'd pop out, and then I could like push it back in. Literally, that's your intestines popping through your abdominal wall. I had it there probably for, I don't know, maybe a year and a half, maybe 2 years, maybe a year and a half. And then finally went and had the surgery. And then this guy that I went to high school with was a security guard at the hospital. And he's like, I saw your surgery. I say him like a couple years later or a year later, like I watched your surgery through the door, because he must have saw the
He was
name. And
looking through the door at you.
that's what he came up to me one time. We were at, either at a party or at the bar or something. I don't know. And he's like, I saw your surgery, man. You're having some operation. I thought that was a little strange, but
Oh, but strange.
yeah. Little, but anyways, yeah. Yeah,
See?
yeah, yeah. But I've never had a. That was the only one I've ever had. That was my only experience of being under anesthesia.
Do you remember him in high school always being a peeping Tom?
well, he's
Was his name Tom?
No, his name is actually Heath, actually, but
Heath.
I won't say his last name, just for anonymity's sake. But yeah, I mean, he was all excited to tell me that, that I saw my surgery. But small town, major hospital there, everyone goes to it. So that kind of stuff, it's like almost like a gossip central. Like, oh, do you know who's in the hospital the other day? Because everyone knows everyone that's, connected. So word, if you do go to the hospital there, the word sort of does sort of travel a little fast because every department usually has someone that knows someone that knows someone. Anyone that lives in a relatively smaller town sort of knows what that means, that there really isn't a lot of privacy. Your stuff kind of gets put out there in some way, shape, or
I
form.
guess in, yeah, literally, quite literally for you.
I mean, it wasn't a big deal. I mean,
I know.
I'm really, it's kind of harmless. But anyways,
Okay.
we'll move on back
Back
to
to risk factors for cardiovascular disease in menopausal women.
Got off topic there. Just you're talking about surgery, and that's the only time I've ever had surgery. But knock on wood, you're gonna have one. That's not a bad one to have. All right, so we are talking about estrogen, menopausal risk. So where do we leave off?
Well, we were talking about inflammation and how in menopause that can create inflammation, that can create insulin resistance. So when you're looking at risk factors, I guess to kind of sum it up, we've got the cholesterol where we're looking at the triglycerides and HDL ratio, not necessarily focusing on the LDLs or the total cholesterol too much, but looking more at the apolipoprotein B. That would be, that one. And then also looking at kind of we were talking about inflammation in terms of visceral fat versus superficial cutaneous fat.
Waist to hip ratio. I think waist to hip ratio, just measuring your waist and your hips. If your waist is bigger than your hips, you're not in a good spot. Your hips need to be bigger than your waist. That sort of adds to that whole visceral fat idea. Usually, if you have a bigger waist to hip ratio, that your visceral fat amount is higher.
And what about apolipoprotein little a?
Lipoprotein A, I think, is a little bit more. That's the one that is a little bit more genetic, right? So that one you would want to do, excuse me, you would want to check maybe as a screening test. If you've never had it done before, you do it one time. If that number is good, then you're fine. If it's high, then you'd probably want to have a strategy of getting that number down. A lipoprotein A, little A, so LP, capital LP, parentheses, little A, and then ApoB, those two should be, I think anyway, should be part of a standard lipid panel, right? I mean, the lipoprotein A, LP, little A, only really needs to be done once unless it's elevated. If it's elevated, you want to get that number down. That one is directly correlated with cardiovascular events for sure. But usually check it once, and if it's normal, then you leave it alone. If it's not, then you address it.
And what about a highly sensitive C-reactive protein or hsCRP?
I mean, they're also called cardio CRP for a reason, because it's meant to sort of mimic the inflammation that, as we've been talking about this whole time, inflammation, the inflammation that's happening inside those coronary blood vessels. Again, it's not diagnostic, but it just adds to this collection of information of where someone's risk is. So insulin, triglycerides, ApoB, LP little A, highly sensitive CRP. There's like five things on blood pressure.
Oh, can I ask you about that? So maybe this is a loaded question, but so what do you think about the new changes with changing blood pressure? Because now it was always, what was it, 120 over 80? Now there's some recommendations saying it needs to be under 120 and under 80.
Well, this is where you have to be a little careful every time they lower these guidelines, because are they just trying to put more people on medication, or is there actually a legitimate reason to actually lower those parameters? To be honest, I haven't looked at it enough. My guess would be is that more people qualify for medication that way, so it just puts more people on drugs. And I don't. Usually, when those things happen, big association, Heart Disease Association, or something like that, which is always, a little nefarious as far as how they come up with their recommendations. I don't really trust a lot of those things.
But needless to say, high blood pressure, that's something to be addressed. Like, that's one thing where if I have a patient that has high blood pressure, I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. We stop everything right now. Stop talking. We got to address that this second because blood pressure is kind of that that's definitely a silent killer.
Sure. Yeah. Blood pressure is in the short term is not going to really cause a problem, but over time, it's going to cause lots of problems.
Oh.
It's going to drive what we're talking about in heart disease. It's going to lead to cardiomyopathy, heart failure, kidney problems, strokes. I mean, yeah. I mean, there's lots of issues. And really, as we're talking about insulin sensitivity or insulin resistance, blood pressure is one of the number one first signs that you have an insulin problem. So if you're like in your 30s, how many people have you seen over the years, male or female, and they got hypertension in their 30s, right?
Like one, honestly.
Oh, I've seen a few. I mean,
Really?
more so men than women, right? And that's going to happen in men, especially again, the bigger that belly, maybe more so when they get to their 40s, maybe not 30s, but more so 40s. But if you're medicated, that's a clue that you have insulin resistance. And then your risk factor for all those other things we're talking about, heart disease and dementia and even cancer, is going to go up proportionally. So you're right. The blood pressure sort of needs to be addressed, and not just from a medication perspective. Maybe in the short term, I think you can address blood pressure very well without long-term medication, but that does take some work and some effort, some dietary change, some exercise, maybe
And some supplementation.
some targeted supplementation. And then now you can control it. I don't have a problem with people having blood pressure below 120 over,
Oh, no.
85. I
Nope.
think they should. I know yours has always been like, do you even have a pulse
Oh,
in
no. I
there?
think it runs like 110 over 70.
Yeah, but you've
It's
had like numbers like 97 over 65.
probably when I was dehydrated or
No, no,
something.
no. I think that you just have really, really, in a good way, you have really low blood
I'm
pressure.
not dizzy. I feel pretty good. I
Yeah.
mean, no, but yeah, I think I do have some patients that have really low blood pressure, and we tend to work more on their adrenals because that's kind of low, really low blood pressure, or even like POTS that can kind of point to working on some of the adrenals and the
Sure.
endocrine. But when we're looking at heart disease, it's that higher blood pressure.
Yeah. Yeah. Blood pressure is one of those very common things. I'm sure, I don't even know the numbers. Millions and millions of people have hypertension. It's not a sodium problem necessarily. If you're consuming sodium, it's going to come from processed food. That's where your sodium's coming from. So is it a sodium issue or is it an,
A food issue.
but if you look up even online, the Ben Bickman, the researcher that I talked about, he's got some videos about a hypertension and insulin resistance. And there's a very specific mechanism, even when they call it idiopathic hypertension or essential hypertension, like we don't know where it comes from. We know exactly where it comes from. It comes from elevated insulin, which then affects your aldosterone, makes you retain water, your blood volume goes up, and your pressure increases, right? Your circulatory system is like the pipes in your house. It's like this closed pressurized system. You put more volume of fluid in there, more plasma basically. That pressure is going to increase, and now you've got hypertension. When you and I were still in Vegas, and I was doing sort of a weight loss, a keto diet with people, I seen some crazy reductions in. By putting him on a keto diet within a week, I remember one gentleman, African American. He was probably at the time in his early 50s, kind of a walking disaster. He needed to lose some weight, which is why he was there. His blood pressure was high, his cholesterol was high, his blood sugar was high. Like he had all the things going on. In 1 week, he lost like 19, actually, it was almost like 48 hours. He lost 19 pounds. Okay, so from going from a normal diet to a keto diet, he lost 19 pounds of fluid, right? And his
Hypertension.
blood pressure went down 50 points.
Wow.
Like 50 points. Like it was unbelievable. I had never, that was pretty early on in your and I's medicine practice career. You want to lower your blood pressure really quick, go on a lower carb diet, and your blood pressure just drops by lowering, because really a keto diet is really a way to lower your insulin burden. You lower your insulin burden, you diurese and pee off all that extra fluid. Carbohydrates, carbs make you retain water. So your blood volume goes up. The more carbs you have, the more your blood volume stays elevated. Now your pressure increases. I've seen that a few times over the years that, literally a keto diet is a great strategy, or just low carb in general is a great strategy for, reducing blood pressure.
All right. Any other risk factors or lab tests to go over, or do you want to kind of go over a little bit of supplementation?
Yeah, I mean, there I know there's a few other
Yeah.
labs like oxidized LDL, and there's a few other ones that you can do. But we touched on, at least from a screening standpoint, or ones that people should be tracking on a regular basis. The ones that maybe already know they have a problem, then maybe some more of that advanced testing is necessary. But yeah, let's dive into some supplementation. What would be like number one on your list?
So again, this is, how do we say it, for educational purposes, blah, 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 not for
Not
medical
for, yeah,
or
check with your
body or
practitioner.
prop,
We're
yeah, to my
we're
stomach.
just educating.
Because we did write down kind of a list here, and I, and this comes up every time we talk about supplements, like, is the omega-3s, and I got to take them myself, and it's, that's like one of the hardest ones for me to take. I don't know why, not because the gel caps are so big. I don't.
There's a bottle in the fridge. I just took a little swig this morning, and just, just a little bit of, and just a little dose out of the bottle.
Okay, but it is everything we talk about. It comes down to that, reducing that inflammation with the EPA and
So we
DHA.
did supplements for menopause. We did cold and flu season supplementation. Now we're doing cardiovascular, and it's literally in every one, omega-3s,
And I've done a couple of articles for the newsletter, for like liver and cold and flu, and I'm like, omega-3s, omega-3s, omega-3s.
Yeah, but we've talked about that even off recording or off the podcast. Other cultures around the world always have an omega-3 source in their daily diet. Not a huge amount, but there's something in their diet that provides them those omega-3s. I don't know how humans develop that knowledge or how we figure those things out. But what we were talking about the other day, so we said omega-3s, collagen. Usually there's a collagen source in, whether that's you're eating tendon of some sort or some type of collagen source, in the diet, usually daily or at least weekly. And then the other one we said was some kind of fermented food. If anyone has any other suggestions about that, please write in the comments down below if you're on YouTube, because I'm at a miss. I can't think of
Joining
any
the
other category.
community.
Yeah, I can't think of any other categories of those areas of nutrition that we don't really think about in America, and at all anymore. Maybe 100 years ago, before we industrialized everything, we certainly did. But now we don't really think about nutrition in those things, where other cultures, they have this history of. Those are the three that I can think of. So if you have any other ideas, write them in the comments. I'd love to kind of expand on that idea a little bit.
And then, of course, vitamin K, that's kind of the new kid on the block about trying to keep the calcium and the cholesterol from adhering to the, or basically more of the calcium adhering to the arterial walls and trying to push it more towards the bones.
Certainly vitamin D and K2. Everyone is sort of on that bandwagon, as you are, you and I are as well. Certainly the K2, talking about the calcification, preventing that deposition inside those coronary blood vessels. As we're talking about, heart disease is still a big deal for everyone in the world. So anything we can do, especially if it's on a daily basis, that's a good one. Omega-3s, K2. What else would be on your list?
Well, we have our little, actually we have a lot of things on our list, and a lot of people are probably familiar with like CoQ10. That's pretty familiar for heart disease. But then other ones that aren't maybe talked about as much is like the curcumin, because curcumin is very anti-inflammatory. Curcumin is the main constituent in turmeric. So people can take a lot of turmeric and black pepper, but sometimes it bothers your stomach that you could just spend a little extra, get the curcumin, which is isolated out of the turmeric, and get a little more bang for your buck.
I remember the first time I went to Okinawa with you, and your grandmother lived in this little tiny little Okinawan village, and there was this little farm, a little farmhouse, and they had a plant growing. These big green stalks growing out of the ground, and I asked your mom what that was, and she said ukon. Ukon is literally turmeric, and I would they had this wonderful tea there. You could buy it at the stores. They had two different types. They had spring turmeric root, dried turmeric root, and they had fall turmeric root, which I thought that was just fascinating. And it come in these little, the root was kind of dried in these little flakes, almost kind of looked like, almost kind of like, corn flakes, but it was turmeric. And I used to make, your mom would buy for me, and I just make tea out of it all the time. I loved it. It was great. But they just, I mean, it was growing. It was all over the place. I mean, the whole island was full of turmeric, just growing. Not, I mean, people were growing it on purpose. It wasn't like a weed or whatever, but it was just everywhere. I thought that was pretty
That
awesome.
was pretty awesome.
Ukon.
That's why they call that the island of longevity.
I think they used to, I can't read Japanese, but I think your mom, when she translated some of the packaging, that's what it would say on some of those turmeric things, is that it'd have the word longevity on there. They're trying to market it as being a, as it is an effective, effective, what would you call it? A botanical, I guess, in that
Yeah,
respect.
hey, that curcumin and that turmeric is powerful stuff. It really is.
So omega-3s, turmeric to addressing the inflammation of heart disease. Now we also, the one that comes up a lot is the magnesium, right?
Yeah, and people are pretty familiar with magnesium and heart health. One thing other people may be familiar with, but for people that have high LDL cholesterol, the red yeast rice will bring that down. I usually do, I'll for those of you in the community, I'll put together a little handout with different doses for the supplements. But the red yeast rice, I can usually get people's LDL cholesterol down about 20 to 30 points, which can be pretty great to look on your blood work. But red yeast rice, but I don't see the red yeast rice bringing down triglycerides. I see it more effective for the LDL
The
cholesterol.
omega-3s will bring down triglycerides. If you, which is sort of strange, you're giving a fat to reduce a blood fat. But literally, like Lavazza and some of the other prescription omega-3s, those are literally a treatment for high triglycerides. Which is interesting. Now you mentioned red yeast rice. So for those that are aware, red yeast rice is basically kind of like a weak statin drug. You and I don't prescribe statins. But if we're going to do something for lipid management, because everyone is concerned about that, we may employ a red yeast rice from time to time.
And I haven't really seen, at least in my clinical practice with who I've worked with, I haven't seen anybody have any problems with it. And when you say it's a mini statin, people get a little freaked out. It just kind of has the similar mechanism of action. So it blocks an enzyme called the coreductase, what is it? HMG coreductase enzyme,
HMG coA
but just
reductase.
slightly, because a lot of people that do have genetically induced LDL cholesterol, like you do, is the liver is making it. You're not necessarily.
What?
You have genetically induced LDL cholesterol
I
because
do not.
your LDL
I do
cholesterol is a little
not.
high.
I do not.
You get it from your dad.
My dad died of his fifth heart attack, so I have a terrible family history.
Which is why we like to talk
But he,
about heart.
but my dad. Well, I mean, yeah. But my dad also drank. He smoked. He had the big beer belly. He had a completely different lifestyle. There's a genetic component, but most of those conditions, there is a significant lifestyle component that mine and his are
Oh yeah, no.
completely different. I don't smoke a pack of cigarettes a day. He
Was
had
the
his,
'70s.
he had it, well, right. Yeah. He had his first heart attack at the age of 45. I was like 5 years old, 4 years old, four. He was 41 when I was born. So he's a little bit older. And then he had his last heart attack, or he passed away when he was 67. So in 22 years, he ended up having five heart attacks. That's sort of why we're doing what we're, well, at least what I'm doing now is sort of because of that. Even back then, realizing drugs and surgery, there's got to be sort of a different way to approach that. Now, when it comes to heart disease, though, unfortunately, no one really has the answer. All right. There's just not a for sure way to prevent someone from having that heart attack or a stroke, which is unfortunate. It'd be nice if we could, figure that out, not only from a risk assessment standpoint, but also preventing that, that major cardiac event. So you're right. From a family history perspective, I'm screwed because I do not have a good family history.
But just because your LDLs might want to run a little, you have that tendency. Things like the red yeast rice can block your own liver from producing it because you're not necessarily, chowing down on, food. Because really it's more about, like you were saying, about the insulin. When you can eat all the fat you want, but when you combine it with carbohydrates, like you could eat a stick of butter, that's not going to necessarily do anything because it made me feel a little queasy. But it's but you throw that on some bread or into some cookie dough or something, that's where you see that insulin go
The
up.
fat and sugar combination is sort of the part that makes the American diet sort of deadly. I'm just checking the time.
Oh yeah, we got to roll.
I have another meeting at in like 5 minutes. So we'll wrap this one up here in a minute. This one we could honestly keep talking and talking and talking. There's so much to go into. So another one that is From a supplementation standpoint, so reduced rice, kind of a weak statin, always pair it, which we do with CoQ10.
CoQ10.
And niacin can be sort of, kind of utilized in there. It used to be really popular probably back in the maybe the early 2000s, to the mid 2000s, 2010, and then it sort of kind of faded away. I don't think it has as much significance anymore than it used to. Some people still may use it, but I know for a while there it was pretty popular.
I think anything in the bee family is great for
Yeah.
everything, but I think things like plant sterols kind of took over, which I don't see as much of effect, but it can have a slight effect. Bergamot is another one that can have a little bit of a slight effect, not as much as you see like
Yeah.
with the red yeast rice when it comes to the LDL cholesterol.
Berberine a little bit.
Berberine that also stabilizes the blood sugar, kind of balances that blood sugar, anti-inflammatory. I know you talk about taurine. I don't usually use taurine too much, but I think it probably could be utilized. I just haven't.
Yeah.
And
Yeah,
then,
there's a
yeah,
bunch of
go ahead.
ribose, you get into the CoQ10, ubiquinol, there's a whole bunch of other things you can use. Now, from an herb standpoint, we didn't talk about too many herbs except for the bergamot, the citrulline and nitric oxide. That was one of the big things that we didn't touch on. Blood pressure, insulin resistance, and nitric oxide production. Those things kind of go, sort of hand in hand. If you have hypertension, you might have low nitric oxide. A way to sort of tell is by, supplementing with some nitric oxide supplementation. Beetroot, you got to be a little careful in what you choose. As far as I know, the reigning expert, his name is Thomas Bryant, or Thomas Bryan. He's a researcher somewhere in Texas, Southwest Medical, something or other, and he's sort of like one of the reigning experts on nitric oxide. There is one that you and I used to use,
Yeah, I
and
think a few different ones. I'm
yeah.
not sure, but you're right. Nitric oxide is great for that endothelial wall and keeping it nice and supple, so
Yeah.
the arteries, because they're not supposed to be like pipes. They're supposed to move and
Yeah.
have the,
Dynamic. Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
dynamics. Not
Yeah.
supposed to be all hard and like a
Yeah.
pipe
Literally,
back fat.
atherosclerosis literally means hardening of the arteries. So they turn into these soft, pliable things that move back and forth,
We
this
want it
way.
pliable,
Yeah, and you
yeah.
want it that way to being rigid and
Like a pipe.
yeah, it's like a lead pipe that doesn't, it's just gonna burst open, which is what we're all trying to prevent. So we have to cut this one
Long
off.
you got a roll.
Yeah. So we'll circle back around because this is obviously important to me, but also important to all of our patients. I'm sure people listening, they either themselves or know someone that that is either has or is going to deal with heart disease in some capacity, just because it's such a pervasive problem. So.
Yeah, so if there's anything that you have any questions about or we might have left out and you want to ask about or you just want to interject, please, please do. And like I said, for the community members, I'll have a write-up with these different kind of protocols and dosing.
Yeah. Until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Valerie.
Take care. Bye-bye.